My name is Kevin Cahill. I'm a reporter, have been various other things, but I've written three very large books on land ownership. The first was about who owns land in Britain and to a lesser extent Ireland. The second one was the key one, because it's about Australia and New Zealand and the Crown's holdings. And the third book was Who Owns Land in Ireland.
Kevin, we've had a big hoo-ha last week with the King visiting Australia and being heckled by the Aboriginals, actually referring to the historical genocide. But also, of course, there's a hint here by the Aboriginals about the genocide going on now in one of Britain's old colonies called Palestine. So what do you make of how much power does Charles really have over there, and how much land does he still have? Because we think of Australia as being pretty much independent nowadays.
Yeah. No, in the old-fashioned legal sense, he is the superior landholder for all land in Australia, including the Antarctic territories. So he is the feudal superior, and he is the ultimate owner of all land in Australia. Now, his effective power depends entirely on the extent to which the Australian state enforces his legal rights. And by and large, the Australian government does enforce King Charles's rights. It claims all of Antarctica in his name, and it repeats his claim to be the feudal superior owner of all that. All kind of transactions in land by the state are done in his name.
Now, we've just had the succession, the coronation, with the Queen dying, etc., and various estimates put his wealth around about something like £1 billion, which has been transferred from his mum to him with no inheritance tax. So that's a little bit controversial in itself. But it sounds to me like he's got power and control over land, which isn't included in that amount. So how much do you think he's really worth?
And in the editions of the Sunday Times Rich List, where I was the kind of royal wealth reporter, we put the Queen's wealth at about 7 or 8 billion. Charles has son, Prince William, has a kind of private holding, the Duchy of Cornwall, where in effect all land in Cornwall is a kind of private possession. However,
because we've got duchy estates here in Wiltshire and in Somerset too, so it's not just Cornwall, is it?
No, they have land in London. The Duchy of Cornwall has land all over the place. A big lump of Dartmoor and all around the Oval in London, but it owns other stuff as well. But the big, and nobody noticed it, I mean, I mentioned it at the time, the coalition government in 2010 formalized the sovereign's ownership of the Crown estate. And the Crown estate is worth tens of billions. Oxford Street, in Whitehall. The land is worth a fortune, but it was made the legal possession of the Crown by the coalition government of David Cameron and Clegg.
Now, we've got this programme coming up on Saturday evening on Dispatches, and I was quite amused to see that there is some sort of legal action rumoured by the royal family to stop the programme, which is looking deeply at the secret hidden wealth of the royal family. And, of course, it's ironic, isn't it, that although they're recommended by ministers, that actually Charles himself now, and previously the Queen, does finalise the appointments of the judges. So it's almost as if he's getting his judges to make a decision about whether or not this program can take place or not, Kevin. But anyway, what do you, you know, if you were to sort of be advising those people looking at this program about the secret wealth, whereabouts do you think we might be expected to find hidden wealth by the royals at the moment?
First of all, most of it isn't recorded properly in the land registry. They haven't completed registration. Most of it, you have to go through newspaper cuttings and that sort of stuff, the way I did long ago. And of course, there's Tony Hall's book on the royal wealth, which has never been republished. And he had a good stab at it. But the basic thing is, Charles is head of state, and it's completely anomalous that the assets of the head of state are not disclosed. The Guardian has covered it fairly well. The hidden approaches to Parliament behind the scenes, lobbying.
This is Rob Evans, isn't he? He's done a fantastic job over the years, the Black Spider letters and this sort of thing. But do you think how much power does the King have? I noticed last Remembrance Sunday, the King going in with the then Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and the former Prime Minister David Cameron for lunch after the ceremony. They've got a big door, they go from the cenotaph into the Foreign Office. And the next morning it was announced that David Cameron was going to be the Foreign Secretary. A very surprise announcement. Well, it wasn't such a surprise if you see the lunch that was taking place in there. So I wonder how much power Charles really does have over these appointments. Things like army officers, things like chief constables, actually even ministers have to be approved by the Crown.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my commission when I was in the army came from the Queen under, it was a rubber stamp, but it was her signature. I was her officer. I was not an officer of the country. I was, if you like, commissioned as her lieutenant, not as a lieutenant in the army of the United Kingdom. But the power is muted because it's influence, but a lot of it is wedged in law. Laws can't be passed and made formal till the King signs them, and that's an awful lot of influence. And then if the King can lobby at private lunches, and Rishi says to him, I think young David here should be promoted to a peer and made the Foreign Secretary tomorrow. That's how it works. It's all behind the scenes.
The coverage of this Australia visit, what did you make of that? Because it was a pretty horrendous, I think, for the King. I mean, he thought hopefully that it was all the ceremonies were going to go off quite nicely, nice lunches and a meeting with the Commonwealth, this sort of thing. But it seems to have been a bit of a fiasco, a bit of a disaster for him.
It was a PR disaster, entirely because of that Indigenous senator. But the tragedy in Australia was there was a referendum to give the Indigenous people a voice in Parliament, and it failed. And in New Zealand, the new government is busy wiping out all the kind of arrangements to integrate the Maori people in New Zealand. There's a lot of bad stuff going on down there.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, because I was over there a couple of years ago, and it was extremely unpopular, this idea that Maori should get a free pass into the political system, because what they were saying was that what you do is you tend to get selected Maoris who don't necessarily represent Maoris as a whole, a little bit like we've got these kind of more commercially minded West Indians who are now running the carnival here in Bristol. It's not anyway. So what do you think is the future for the monarchy? Because, you know, obviously there's a lot of power there. Charles is not likely to just walk away, is he?
No, I mean, those who have great wealth almost never give it up, especially if it's landed wealth. But I don't think Labour are up for it. But we need a new constitution in which the position of the monarch is regularized. And because of the power, the hidden power of the monarchy, all the assets are fully disclosed.
Because this, I think, was a big problem for Rob Evans. He found, as he was disclosing the influence that the king had, so the Freedom of Information Act was tightened up to make sure he couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, it still goes. I mean, on almost every act, especially if it affects land, or the crown has private consultations that are not recorded or disclosed. That's wrong. If Parliament is doing something, that should be in the public domain.
What about this accusation of being a genocidalist? I think when most people heard it, they were thinking of the current genocide and Britain's role in that. And actually, you know, not just a historic role, in actually actively supporting it now with arms supplies to the Israelis. I mean, you're a former soldier. What do you make of this?
Well, the rules of law, as I learned them in the academy, are being totally broken by the Israelis. The word genocide confuses it. This is simple mass murder by an out of control military. Yes, it does amount to genocide, looking at what the IDF has done to the Palestinians in Gaza. I mean, this is Nazi style ghetto. First of all, you put people in ghettos and then you murder them. The Israelis hate it when you say that's what the Nazis did.
Also, I can't have you on, Kevin, without asking you about the slight problem with mass surveillance. I mean, we've now got mass surveillance going on in Britain, which covers both journalists and also parliamentarians. It covers lawyers. So all of the safeguards against surveillance, which used to be there. So, for example, if you wanted to put a journalist under surveillance, you had to go and get
a warrant.
From the judge. This is just willy-nilly. And we've recently seen various journalists being detained or arrested or their contact books taken by the police, which then could possibly be used for those journalists to be targeted. Sorry, those contacts in Gaza or the West Bank or whatever to be targeted by the Israelis if that information from the police leaks to the Israelis. So this is getting quite serious now, isn't it?
Well, most people wouldn't remember there was a worldwide cybersecurity conference in London in 2018. And there were a significant number of Israelis at it. And they were all talking about their complete access to the data stolen by the Americans. They quite literally assumed an entitlement. And in the United Kingdom, the Americans are running mass surveillance, illegal, criminal, unlawful.
We've got this thing called GCHQ in Cheltenham. There's also the NSA in the United States that do all this data gathering. I think they want something called total information awareness, you know, so that everything is theirs. That's the way they see it. This is part of the Five Eyes, but actually it seems to me that maybe the Five Eyes, by the way, is Britain and America, also Australia, New Zealand and Canada. But it seems like the Israelis might have an in there too.
Well, based on the conversations around that, you know, across desks and at the lunches and things, the Israelis have complete access to all the data stolen by the Americans.
So maybe the journalists that are being arrested, their contact books are being stolen by the Americans and then just passed to the Israelis for them to use to target and kill people.
That looks like what. And it's not just journalists being arrested. 172 journalists and a significant number of their families have been murdered. I mean, this is the worst journalistic crisis. The number of dead is greater than World War II in just 12 months.
No, it's amazing. I mean, Chris Hedges has just called it the war on journalism.
It is a war. 172 journalists, not counting the number of family members murdered quite often at the same time. I mean, this is outrageous.
Just getting back to the finally back to the surveillance, is anything happening on the legal front to give guarantees to lawyers, to members of parliament, to journalists, that they won't have their details stolen by the state?
Those kind of guarantees are utter rubbish. But you put your finger on something very interesting, GCHQ. Now, I have a formal relationship with GCHQ. You know, I'm a hack and they have a press office and I talk to them. On the 1st of November 2018, the Irish Intelligence Service threw a GCHQ director out, a fellow called Kieran Martin. And they told him, and they issued a press statement, that because of the relationship between GCHQ and the NSA, the Irish would not give any assistance. And that was public. Nobody here even, nobody mentioned it. The Guardian didn't report it, nothing. It's extraordinary. I mean, I'm not sure that the only journalist the Irish intelligence people sent the press statement to maybe was me. But they did. So they made a public statement saying, no, you're in bed with the NSA. Sorry, can't help.
Well, you might find that whoever did that within the Irish intelligence services no longer has their job. That seems to be the way this kind of mafia operates these days. So, I mean, is there any way that individuals that have had, I'm thinking about people like Richard Medhurst, I'm thinking about Asa Winstanley, Sarah Wilkinson, Craig Murray, that these people can take a legal challenge about their data as journalists and their contacts being taken?
Well, I mean, I found a way around it because I went to the Investigatory Powers Tribunal of the High Court is the special part of the High Court that deals with the spooks. Well, my case is there. They have accepted the case and it's being looked at now by the court. And I can't tell for how it's going to turn. Courts are casinos. You can never be sure how it's going to play out. But I can't see the High Court accepting the situation. If they do accept it, everything is gone. The whole idea of law and order in Britain is finished. If the judges won't uphold the law, then the whole show is over. So I'm very curious to see what comes out. The other thing on which there's been no reporting, in July, we changed governments. Now, a big element of the change of government is the mass surveillance and GCHQ. Have you seen any reporting anywhere? I certainly haven't.
So how has it changed? Just because the government's changed?
Well, in theory, okay, Long ago, do you remember Dennis Healey? He was the Labour, he was the Minister of Defence in Harold Wilson's government. I was friendly with him and I was having a drink with him one time. And he told me, I was in my office in the Ministry of Defence. And he said, this guy in a suit came in. He didn't introduce himself or show a identification, and he told the defense secretary what he couldn't do, gave him his orders. Very largely it was to do with what the Americans wanted in Britain.
So who was this guy?
Dennis Healey never found out. He assumed he was from Six, but he didn't know. He said he was never introduced. Just a man in a grey suit.
Oh, God. Well, that sounds a bit spooky. Look, let's finish just on your books, though. Can you just remind listeners about your books on Who Owns Britain, Who Owns the World, and Who Owns Ireland?
Yeah, the last one, Who Owns Ireland, was really tricky. Ireland is now owned by, well, the land of Ireland is owned by the state. When the Free State was created and then the Republic, the ownership of the land was left in the hands of the state. Now, all the Irish freeholders think they're all the owners of their farms and houses. They're not. The Irish state, like the king in Britain, is the ultimate owner of all land. But the arrangement in Ireland is different from most countries. The majority of the actual acreage is owned by effectively small farmers. This is what it took 150 years, but this is what happened. And the second group, big group of owners, are people who own their own homes, subject, of course, to the state, who is the, like the king in Australia, is the superior owner of all land. So the book wasn't a list of the Irish book, a list of, you know, who owned, but what it was, it filled a gap in history. It listed all the big estates that were converted into small farms. So that's, it was an intermediate book.
Yeah, but you've just reminded me of the slight problem with inheritance tax there is in Britain now, where they've kept the threshold at £325,000. So if you've got a house worth more than that, you have to pay inheritance tax. So that means that if you your son or daughter doesn't have the cash to pay the tax, then you have to sell the house. Now, this is actually the average house price here in Bristol. So more and more people are finding that they can't pass their homes on to their children, Kevin.
Yeah, no, again, it wasn't tackled effectively in the budget. But where the budget did hit, and again, a lot of people, you know, it was just bloody farmers. A lot of people didn't notice, but the budget did point the arrow at the big estates. You know, you can no longer get tax relief if the farm is worth over £1 million. That is the first move to start taxing the residual estates that are in the first book, Who Owns Britain. Most of them are actually recorded in that book.
You know, £2 million of land from a farm, it is going to be taxed now, anything over that. So it's going to be more difficult to pass family farms on. It seems to me the tax burden is always on the little people, not on the big guys with all their wealth, either massive estates like the royal estates or else people with their money in tax havens, Kevin.
My hunch is that they've taken the first step to differentiate between farms and estates. It's hidden in there and nobody's really picked up. The farmers are screaming, but it's not actually the farmers. Behind the farmers are the big estates. And the people who are screaming and saying we can't pass our farm to our children are actually the owners of the big estates. And this is a first step. It's a very tentative step, but it's the first one. So that is going to happen. And it is aimed at the big estates. And they know it. That's why they're screaming. A farm worth £1 million is quite small. But you probably recall that 70% of all, not by farmers, but by big estates.
70% of land is owned by these big estates. But don't they keep the land in trust so they don't pay any inheritance tax?
Nope. You see, they were classed under the Tory government. All the estates and everything were classed as farms. So, of course, they didn't have to pay any tax.
But now that's changed. Anyway, that's a fascinating insight into the budget. Kevin Carhill, thanks very much for joining us.
Not at all, Tony. A pleasure.